Tavis Smiley, and I am delighted to have you with us today in this hour, which I've been looking forward to, because in this hour, we're going to talk to the president and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund. This year, believe it or not, marks 10 years, a decade has gone by just that fast, since Michael Brown Jr.'s life was violently cut short by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. We will talk in this hour about the long shadow of Ferguson and the myriad obstacles we still face when it comes to protecting our children and improving their futures. I am pleased to welcome once again to this program the president and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund, the Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson. How are you, Doc?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me back, brother.
No, it's good to have you on the program. Let me jump right in with a couple of things that are in the news. I want to go here first. Let me go from Ferguson, St. Louis, down to Tennessee. We'll work our way back up, maybe over to D.C., so we'll move around in this hour. But let me go to Tennessee first, because we saw breaking news yesterday that in the state of Tennessee, they have now passed legislation that allows teachers and staff to carry concealed weapons, concealed handguns on public grounds, public school grounds. Now, if that ain't enough, they also are allowed to bar parents and other teachers from knowing who, in fact, is armed. So they're allowing teachers and staff to carry guns on public school campuses, but parents don't know who's carrying. Other teachers and administrators don't know who's carrying. This is a hot mess. And yet, what I call a hot mess is now law in the state of Tennessee. When it comes to protecting, as I said a moment ago, our children and improving their futures, how do you square that kind of legislation with that goal?
Yeah, no, thank you for lifting this up. There's absolutely no way to square care for children and centering their well-being with passing this law, especially at a moment here now, a year after the Covenant School shooting there in Tennessee that drew attention to the state, drew activists to the issue of gun control, including many Republican women. And at a time when 7 children per day are dying by firearms, when firearms are the number one cause of death for children in America, this just doesn't square. House Speaker Sexton is not thinking about the children of the state of Tennessee. We're deeply interested in this at the Children's Defense Fund on several levels, not only because we care about children, but because we also find our historic home in the state of Tennessee, in Clinton, Tennessee, mm-hmm. The home of one of the more difficult desegregation cases in American history. We gather young people every year to talk about how they should raise their voices against these kinds of elements of legislation. And so there's no way to square this. It is a call for people all over the country who care about children, who choose children and not guns, to be active in this election, to raise this, frankly, in their state legislatures, to raise this also as a federal election issue. This is something that President Biden attempted to do some work on. He opened the office of the first presidential office on violence prevention, really focused on gun violence. So this is something we should all be talking about. This is not just about Tennessee. This is about the country. And it's about the choice between our children and our guns.
When you mentioned the farm, you mentioned Tennessee. I've not forgotten about it, but my mind went back to the 2 or 3 occasions on which your brilliant predecessor and the founder of CDF, Marion Wright Edelman, invited me to speak to students on that farm. It's quite a place, as you well know, to have been invited by Marion to speak there a couple times was and remains on the list of high moments of my career. So when you mentioned Clinton, my mind immediately went to the times I spent with the brilliant Marion Wright Edelman on that campus in that space. When we come forward, I want to just probe a bit further this factoid you just shared with us. And I guess it's not foreign to me, I know this, but hearing it come out of your mouth in the context of this conversation and in the context of what just happened in Tennessee yesterday, allowing teachers and administrators to carry concealed weapons, concealed firearms, when you suggest to me that firearm deaths are the number one cause of death amongst children in this country, I mean, think about that. We're supposed to be a civilized nation, and the number one cause of death amongst children in this country is firearms? Let's talk about that part and more when we come forward with the Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, President and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund on Tavis Smiley.
From the Merck Park with love, this love. Is Tavis Smiley. More honesty than you can handle.
More empowerment than you can imagine.
You're tuned in to Tavis Smiley.
Starsky Wilson, no naivete in asking this question, but how is it in this country that the number one cause of death for children can be guns, can be firearms?
Well, that can happen because the gun lobby is well situated within the context of capitalism, has power, and has accumulated that with our lawmakers and children, including those, frankly, I even say teenagers. The young people who were marching for their lives didn't have a vote. And so because we continue to disenfranchise children and because we've not kind of frankly, pull together the moral capacity to vote on their behalf, to cast elections as really about the future and not about individual candidates in the present. That's how we get to this place. And so, you know, whether parents want it, our friends at Everytown have already surveyed this. Parents don't want the guns in teachers' hands. Teachers don't want the guns in teachers' hands. And it is proven to provide a challenge to students' trust in the educators in order to be able to get their education. And so this is a bad move on all fronts. But again, this is a call to those who are willing to invest their votes for their grandchildren and their children to speak on this issue and frankly call our candidates to speak on this issue, especially this year.
Yep. I don't mean to make you political, but since you went there, I want to follow you. I know that Children's Defense Fund is a nonprofit. I understand that, and nonpartisan. And yet you put your finger on something that I think we ought to interrogate here just for a few moments, and hopefully you'll play along with me here because you made the point, so you got me thinking about it. When you were talking a moment ago, I thought of the edict of Bill Clinton, who said famously years ago, that every election is about the future. It seems simple enough, but when it came out of his mouth in the context in which he said it, it resonated with a lot of people, that every election is about the future, never about the past. And for those who were around in the Clinton years, you'll recall the theme song of the campaign, "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow," Fleetwood Mac. Every election is about the future and never about the past, said Bill Clinton. I think he's right about that. But here you come now, just sort of upending my thinking in this regard. Because every election really isn't about the future. It's really about the president, about the present and about the president in real time. And so you're right. We end up voting for candidates. Elections are about candidates. They're really not about the future. And we ain't even got into the frame yet about voting on behalf of the children. I'm just starting, before I get to that, I'm just starting with the fact that maybe every election, maybe Clinton was wrong. Maybe ostensibly it should be about the future. But maybe that was an aspirational point. But in reality, I think you're right. I'm not so sure in this year or any other year we're really thinking about the future. Let me take it another step further. I've had more than one guest on this program, more guests, Frankie Starsky Wilson, than I can count, who keep making the point that Donald Trump is an existential threat to this democracy. And I don't care what your other concerns are, what your gripes are, what your issues are. I just spent a half hour talking about reparations. I keep having guests say to me, we have to set all of that aside for the moment and do anything and everything we must to make sure that Donald Trump is not reelected. You might not like Joe Biden. He might not be perfect. He's running for president, not the Pope. I mean, I've heard all these mantras, all these one-liners, but the point is we got to get this guy, this one guy. It ain't about the future. It's about right now, and we got to get this guy in. I digress. Your thoughts?
Well, I think we find ourselves in a conversation only about the present if we don't have an articulated agenda for our future, is my first thought. I'll come back to that. The second thing I think about that is really that we find us, we don't actually have to separate these two things. I don't have to set aside my commitment to children's well-being and them growing up in just and caring communities and having stable families and economic mobility, these commitments to the American dream. I don't have to set that aside in order to choose between two, three, or four candidates, depending on how you want to look at this. Actually, I keep that in mind. And I assess those four options through what I desire for my children. And so I just say it's, I think it's a little bit lazy to say we have to set it all aside because one person's an existential threat. Frankly, we should say, as I do, that because I am deeply committed to an agenda for children that has to find its way through the Senate and through the House, it has to make its way through the congressional chambers and get to the White House, it has to make its way through somebody's city council and make it to City Hall, then I have to engage in a political process that chooses between the options that are given to me. So it's not that I have to put it down. It's actually that I have to keep it squarely in front of me and say, if I want children to be safe, I got to choose between these four options.
Yeah.
And there is a better option. And I got to make that case to people. And I think we can effectively make that case.
Yep.
But on the first point, I mean, you helped to inform me on this many moons ago at a critical point in my own formation. If I don't have an articulated commitment to what I want for my future, Covenant with Black America 2006, if I don't have a commitment to what I want for my future, State of Black America, National Urban League annually, if I don't have a commitment to what I want that future to be, State of America's Children, Children's Defense Fund each year, then I must vote on the present. Mm-hmm. So the question is, have I done the long-term work to articulate my hopes for children? And I want my kids to grow up with dignity, hope, and joy. And that has a policy agenda to go on with it. Yeah. So I get to vote on the future.
Since you went there, let me just mention, I may have done it before. You mentioned the Covenant with Black America. It did come out in 2006. The work on that actually began in 2004. So this is essentially the 20th anniversary of the Covenant. And to that end, the 20th anniversary edition of that book will be out this summer. I literally yesterday just approved, just signed off on the cover design, which is quite nice. So sign off on the cover. My introduction has been written. All the new essays have been written. And speaking of the Covenant, as you well know, the person who wrote the introduction, the foreword to the Covenant 20 years ago was Marion Wright Edelman. I asked her to write the first words that you read in that book, and her words 20 years ago were brilliantly crafted. And we start this 20th anniversary edition with those words. So there's a lot of new content in this book 20 years later, but you will still read Marion Wright Edelman's words, the founder of the Children's Defense Fund, in this new 20th anniversary text, because they were so rich and powerful then. They are as rich and powerful 20 years later. And so since you mentioned it, I thought I'd just throw that out there. So we'll be talking more about that in the coming months. But the 20th anniversary of the Covenant will be out later this year, just in time for these conventions and just in time for these elections. So you see what I'm doing here. So I've been busy. Go ahead.
I'm going to tell you the other thing you're doing. Between the other segment that we're talking about, Tennessee, and this segment, you're crafting for yourself another invitation back to the farm to talk to us about these things, because it sounds like the time is right and the place is right. So you're doing what you're doing, but you're doing something else too. So thank you.
No, I appreciate you saying that. And anytime I'm invited to the farm, trust me, I'm headed to Tennessee. So I look forward to the invitation, and I can tell you now, I'm confirming. Whenever we can work it out, I'm confirming. I'll come back to the farm. We're back to the farm, that is. That said, let me get back to this notion you were discussing a moment ago. I'm curious. This is really a choice question, it's not a question about choice. Rather, it's a question about process. So I'm not asking ultimately who one should vote for. I ain't talking about Biden or Trump or even my friend Cornel West or Bobby Kennedy or Jill Stein. It's not a choice question. It's a process question, and this is the question: if we were processing how we're going to vote, if we were processing who we're going to vote for, but did so looking through the lens of what it means for babies, Black babies and other babies yet unborn, help me understand what our thinking should be focused on. I'm talking, again, it's a process question, not a choice question, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I think first and foremost, we need to call on these candidates to lift up what they're doing, what their commitments are around children and young people. So from a process standpoint, we should be engaging and calling the question for children and young people. And I will just say, I don't find any of the presidential candidates to have been as forthright in their articulated platforms for the commitments to children as they need be. Mm-hmm. So I just say that to say there's work to do for all of the stated candidates as it relates to their commitment to children. So we should be calling for that, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, we should be assessing what they have already done. In the presidential election, you have two major party candidates who have records related to children and young people. In one candidate, you have someone who, under his administration, you saw scores of young people, hundreds of thousands of young people taken off of Medicaid rolls. Frankly, you still see some challenges with that. You see another who expanded the child tax credit for a time and has an opportunity to try to advance it again. So you can look at what they've done. And I'd say that's a federal, but it can be local as well, right? Mm-hmm. Or at the state level. One of the most closely watched Senate races we're going to have in the country is going to be in Pennsylvania, because it has federal and national implications. And you've got Bob Casey there, who has been advancing an agenda around freedoms for children for a number of years. And you see him advancing now an approach to something akin to baby bonds to set up child savings accounts. Like, these are things we should be asking specifically. So from a process standpoint, call them to put their cards on the table for children and young people in town halls and public forums, on their online platforms, and assess what they've already done. Those who have a record, call them on that record and talk about those records in your churches. Talk about those records in your fraternity and sorority convenings. Talk about those records from book clubs. Like, this is what we should be book clubbing and talking about this summer, and then engage in collective discernment. Mm-hmm. I think we have better assessment in a group than we have on our own. I don't have to check my identity when I go through the voting booth. I am a Black man raised Baptist in the South in the context of the Black church, right? All of that informs how I show up. And those are some of the people I need to be talking to when I discern what's best for us, because, you know, voting is a collective practice. And so those are three steps that I want to suggest we ought to be engaging in as we process what we are, how we're going to make our votes, how we're going to make our voices known this summer, in some cases, frankly, this spring in some of these primary elections, and ultimately this fall in the federal election.
I love talking to Starsky Wilson primarily because he always makes me think and consider things differently and look at issues and situations and circumstances through different prisms. He does what we try to do at our best on this program every day. He challenges me to re-examine the assumptions I hold. It always helps me to expand my inventory of ideas, and oftentimes reminds me of things I've forgotten about. That I was kind of chuckling inside. It goes to show how there are a number of points here, but it goes to show how troubled the world is in some respects. We're talking about Israel and Palestine. We're talking about state of Tennessee passing bills that allow teachers to carry concealed weapons in classrooms. We're talking about a variety of things on the docket, so much on the docket that it didn't even occur to me that I've not mentioned as yet that Joe Biden won the Pennsylvania primary yesterday. And I didn't mention it because it's such a foregone conclusion, right? It just occurred to me when you mentioned Pennsylvania that that was the primary state yesterday. Joe Biden wins the primary in Pennsylvania, but who's talking about it? Who cares? I mean, it's such a foregone conclusion that this is, I can't even call this a primary season. Because he and Mr. Trump have just run the table, and I don't like that. And when I say I don't like it, I don't mean that Joe Biden ought to have competition per se. What I'm saying is that this process is such a fait accompli that you don't have any real contestation. There's no robust exchange of ideas. There's no dialogue. It's just a done deal. And I don't think that that's the way things ought to be done in the democracy. I'll get off my soapbox. I digress on that point for now. But this is what happens when you just running the table, that you forget that there was a major primary yesterday in a swing state like Pennsylvania. That's a big deal. And I ain't mentioned it one time. And here comes Starsky Wilson reminding me of Pennsylvania yesterday because it just ain't on the docket because it's so, you know, it's already done. I digress on that point again. Let me just ask you this right quick. Let me set this up. I'm looking at my clock. Got about 90 seconds. Wouldn't be fair to give you such an abbreviated time to address this. But if my memory serves me correctly, you hail from the St. Louis area, do you not?
I spent 20 years there.
Yeah.
I grew up in Dallas, but 20 years before coming to D.C., I was in St. Louis.
That's what I thought.
So
yeah,
it's in many ways home.
That's right. I knew you were from the South, from Dallas, but spent 20 years in St. Louis. I wanted to make sure I had my point of reference right because I want to get his unique take. So then you were in St. Louis right next to Ferguson, or Ferguson next to St. Louis, depending on how one looks at it. You were in that region 10 years ago when they killed Michael Brown, were you not?
I was.
Okay. So when we come forward, I want to get his unique take. Believe it or not, we are pushing toward, in just a couple few months, pushing toward the 10th anniversary of the killing of Michael Brown, Jr. And I want to get Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson's reflections on the 10th anniversary of that particular murder, that particular death, and look at the impacts, the long-term impacts of that that case 10 years later. I'm Tavis Smiley. He's Starsky Wilson. He is the fine president and CEO of the Children's Defense Funds. I mentioned earlier, in case you've just tuned in, always want to shout out Marion Wright Edelman, who was the founder of this grand organization, and she made a wise choice. I won't offer any more commentary than this, but I know a lot of people who've made some unwise choices in their successors, and I'll leave that where it is. But she made a wise choice in Starsky Wilson, and I'm pleased to have him back on this program. More with him when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Unapologetically progressive. Progressive. Unapologetically blind. Black. You're tapped into Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
Helping to make you the most knowledgeable person in your circle of friends. This is Tavis Smiley.
This is Tavis Smiley in conversation with the Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, who is the president and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund. He is from Dallas, Texas, from the South. But spent a couple of decades in St. Louis and was in St. Louis 10 years ago this year when they killed Michael Brown Jr. And I want to talk now for a few moments about the long shadow of Ferguson. We've been talking about what it means to be seriously committed to protecting our children and to preserving their rights and standing up for them and ensuring that they have a brighter future. We've been talking about this bill passed yesterday in Tennessee that allows teachers in schools to carry concealed weapons. I don't know that makes any sense at all. Somebody once said it was a bad idea when they thought about it, but we've been discussing that in the context of what we are truly doing in this country to protect, again, the futures of our children and, for that matter, babies yet unborn. And so I circle back to Michael Brown and what happened 10 years ago in Ferguson, because that certainly sent a lot of our children, a lot of young people into the streets protesting what they had done to Michael Brown Jr. But Reverend Starsky Wilson, you were there. Take me back 10 years ago, sir, and give me your thoughts and reflections, and we'll talk about, again, the long shadow of Ferguson a decade later.
No, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. Frank, I'm actually headed to St. Louis today to talk about this some more with a gathering of the Association of Black Foundation Executives who are there honoring this anniversary of the Ferguson Uprising and giving tribute to this fallen 18-year-old whose death invited the uprising of other youth from across the community and across the country. So I said a few things. So when I was on August 9th, 2014, I was pastoring a church there in North St. Louis, just a few miles from the place where Michael Brown was killed. I was the CEO of a foundation focused on child well-being and racial justice in the St. Louis community. And I ended up serving as co-chair of the Ferguson Commission appointed by the governor. And so I was called into this work in a whole lot of different ways. But first and foremost, I was called to the image of Michael Brown lying in his own life force in the midst of the street. And I named that because in that way, that police violence that happened that day connected to the community violence that I experienced in my own life and continues to traumatize young people and draw them into this area of precarity, this sense of trauma in our own experiences. And so so that day and that moment was a calling in to the reality that young people's lives are on the line in all kinds of policy. I won't go too far here, but I'll just say Michael Brown died on the dividing line between an unaccredited school district and an accredited school district, and he had just graduated from a non-accredited school district. Mm. I say this because it's a point of policy about how we separate supports for children and young people and how we create categories not to take care of some of them, including folks like Michael Brown Jr. So I'll talk about, you know, kind of the long legacy here. A few things came out of this that I think stay with us. Number one, a focus on youth mobilization in a way that we hadn't seen it in many ways since the student movement, especially in the Black community. So I, because of the church that I serve, St. John's Church, we have the occasion to host the Ferguson Freedom Ride, which is the first national mobilization of what we came to call Black Lives, the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. And that happened within weeks after Michael Brown died. So I'll say first and foremost, this mobilization of Black young people around issues that has lasted for a decade began in many ways, in real concrete ways, there at the Ferguson Uprising. Number two, it came in a trail, of course, of these publicized, televised, streamed police shootings that take us to 2020. And I don't know if we had the same kind of capacity to respond to George Floyd in that moment, to respond for Breonna Taylor in that moment, if we had not been led out and built infrastructure because of what happened to 18-year-old Michael Brown 6 years before. And so there's a capacity mm-hmm. for community mobilization as part of the long trail that comes from here as well. But then getting to the point of what I was naming from my own trip and who I'll be with tomorrow, there was a sensitization of philanthropy and organized resources to support movement that's also a part of the long trail. So I don't know that you see the kind of investments of even the Mackenzie Scotts of the world in 2020 and otherwise responding to racial justice issues if you don't have the kind of groups like the Executives Alliance of Boys and Men of Color, the Association for Black Foundation Executives, actually descending into the St. Louis community to help provide uplift to the demands of organizers on the ground so that we might hear the voices of a Leslie McSpadden and a Michael Brown Sr. Supporting their amplification of the work. And so I think it was critical in so many ways. And it only happened, last thing I'll say on this, it only happened because young people decided to go outside and not go back in until somebody gave them some answers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For more than a year, standing outside the Ferguson Police Department for more than a year were young people who were activated on August 9th, 2014. They didn't go in when the governor named a task force in the Ferguson Commission. They didn't go in when the president named the policing task force. They didn't go in when people did all these things to try to process their emotions. They stayed outside and they held witness and vigil for their fallen brother and against a system that was absolutely evil, that continues to be evil in America. Policing in America continues to be evil. It continues to discriminate. It continues to take life. It continues to traumatize children. It continues to separate families. And those young people held vigil for a year until we would all have time to pay attention and catch up. And so I think that's part of the long legacy. We have to lift up the witness of these young people at every chance we get.
There are at least a couple of questions that come to mind immediately, given what you just said. I didn't want to interrupt because you were preaching just then, in fact, Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson. I'm not naive in asking this, but in the 90 seconds I have here now, respond to this and we'll continue when we come forward. But I note, I note now, and I've noted in the past, that you never mention Michael Brown Jr.'s name, even a decade later, without prefacing it with the 18-year-old Michael Brown Jr. I've never heard you say his name one time without saying the 18-year-old Michael Brown Jr. Why do you do that?
I do that because we continue to try to adultify. We look at a young child and we make them older than they are. I do that because I know that brain development suggests that he was still forming his identity because the brain forms through age 24. I do that because I knew he just graduated from high school, one of the most significant hallmarks in life, and we need to humanize this young man as he was, rather in a way to reconcile and reclaim him from the court system that tried to demonize and make of him an animal. And so he was one of our own. I got a 19-year-old son. I got a 16-year-old son. He was one of our own. And no matter what you want to think about that narrative, he needs to be reclaimed for the son that he was, for the grandson that he was, and now for the ancestor that he is and all of his whole humanity.
Ferguson and the murder of Michael Brown Jr., has created a long shadow, a shadow that still must be wrestled with even a decade later. And when we come forward, I want to wrestle with a couple of things that Reverend Starsky Wilson, the president and CEO, of the Children's Defense Fund has raised, but I want to just go inside it a little more in depth. And that is these pretextual stops that end up leading to the death of too many of our children. These pretextual stops, we just saw it in Chicago. That young man shot, what, 96 times in 41 seconds in Chicago. These pretextual stops because your tail light is out or your license plate is, you know, is dated. But these pretextual stops say nothing of the predatory policing that we saw in Ferguson and all the data that came out about that police force after the murder of Michael Brown Jr. So we'll talk about that part when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
This is getting good.
Yeah, man.
Tavis Smiley, continues when we come forward. May Fresh Daily in the Mert Park,
Los Angeles, California.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, have we made any progress with these pretextual stops, this predatory policing that we came to know all too well post the murder of Michael Brown Jr.?
We have made some progress primarily because we know there are now penalties. Arch City Defenders, a holistic legal and impact litigation firm in St. Louis, recognized that the year before Michael Brown was killed, 86% of all motorists stopped by police in Ferguson were Black. So we know it's discriminatory. But since then, they've also won two cases or settlements in Ferguson and another in neighboring Jennings with $1 million, so $1.7 million, $4.5 million, $4 million class action lawsuits for this. And so now the cities have to consider what is the economic impact of these stops and create more oversight. Of course, we have the challenge of the interruption of monitoring of consent decrees in the Trump administration by the Department of Justice. So there's less direct oversight. Again, one of the choices in this election. But because there's a penalty, because there are more oversight, citizen civilian review and oversight boards across the country now than there were then, because more attention is on this, we do see some progress and sensibility around it. I'm not best positioned to speak to kind of statistical change, sure, but I do think it's progress that we have more eyes on it.
Let me do this now. I want to tee this question up, and I'll let Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, President and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund, unpack this when we come forward in our remaining moments with him. Just had a conversation, as I mentioned earlier, prior to Reverend Dr. Wilson talking about reparations and how there is a movement in this country to make Joe Biden and others, for that matter, earn the Black vote. And there's a particular push to get him to establish a reparations commission between now and November, before November. And the view is that if he will do that, if he will establish a reparations commission between now and November, he will run away with the Black vote, which he needs desperately in huge numbers to win this election and stave off Donald Trump. He promised to put a Black woman on the Supreme Court. He did that with KBJ. And so the thinking is, if he does that on this particular issue, establishing this reparations commission before November, that he would run away with the Black vote. That is the thinking behind this particular strategy. So in that light, I want to ask Starsky Wilson, when we come forward, is there something that we ought to be pushing this particular president to do, and for that matter, Congress? But is there something we ought to be pushing him to do right now, before November, to show his, their, Democrats and others, their commitment to children? Is there something we ought to be pressing them on right now before November when they ask us to give them a second chance? We'll do that when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward. Let's get back to more of this rich dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, who is the president and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund. In case you've just tuned in, you've missed an amazing hour. I encourage you to go to our platforms beyond today's program. Check out the podcast of this conversation. If you missed any part of it, I promise you, you'll be enlightened, encouraged, inspired, and empowered by the conversation. In the 3 minutes I have left, which I will yield to the gentleman from the CDF, the question I posed a moment ago is whether or not there are things on the agenda that CDF would love to see get done between now and November. If so, tell me what.
Yep. So I'll say two commitments on the federal level. Number one, in 2017, I apologize for getting granular here. In 2017, the Government Accountability Office and the Office of Management and Budget recommended that the director in the establishment of their cross-agency priorities, this is all the goals for across the executive branch coordinated together, would include and focus on child well-being, to include working with relevant agencies to ensure that every strategic plan considered child well-being. And since 2017, several budget cycles have come and gone, and no action has been taken on that. This is within presidential authority, so you got candidates who are saying they want to lead into the future. One way they can name that is to commit publicly to acting on the Government Accountability Office's commitment or direction and recommendation that every federal agency across board should integrate a commitment to child well-being into their strategic plan. That's number one. On executive action, something that could happen, I'm sorry, on legislative action, something that can happen before the election is the child tax credit. The House has passed a bipartisan version of the child tax credit that would impact 16 million low-income families and their children. 500,000 would be lifted out of poverty, lifted above the poverty line if the legislation is fully fulfilled according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. What it takes right now, if you're in one party, then I say to your presidential candidate, you can direct the speaker or the majority leader to put it up for a vote. It can be put up for a vote at any given time. That can happen. It has been sat on since February, since the House sent it over. A Democrat can gavel that to call for a vote. If you're a Republican, you can call on your presidential candidate to whip the 10 Republican votes that are needed for this. Frankly, there's one Republican who seems to be stopping it. His name is Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho. He's the ranking Republican on the Finance Committee who seems to be holding this up for reasons that are purely political but have nothing to do with children. But we can lift 16 million children out of poverty if these two candidates who have full authority of their parties, one would direct his majority leader to call for a vote and the other would make sure that 10 Republican votes are there, are willing to come out. Frankly, we think the votes are already there, are willing to actually come out publicly and pass this legislation to lift 16 million children.
Those are the kind of answers that I love. Direct, straightforward, concise, clear, transparent. Now you know what to press Joe Biden on. Now you know what to press Donald Trump on. Cornel West, Bobby Kennedy, all the rest of them, as it relates to our precious babies. You know what the agenda is, courtesy of the Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, who is the president and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund. Doc, always an honor to have you on this program. Once again, I thank you, as I always do, for your work and your witness ongoing. For holding up the bloodstained banner, especially for these babies. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We'll do it again somewhere down the road, sir.
Appreciate you, dear brother. Thank you.
Good to have you on the program. When we come forward in our third and final hour today, Wendell Pierce, brilliant thespian, great brother, owner of a talk radio station in New Orleans. Look forward to our dialogue with Wendell Pierce when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.